And so he had taken these men up with him, three of the disciples, Peter, James, and John. And he had left the other ones down with the crowd. And while he was up on the mountain, those that had gone with him had seen his glory. They said that his clothes had become radiant and they were white as nothing could bleach them on earth. And they talk about Peter was so afraid that he started saying, oh, well, let me make something for you. You know, he was wanted to make a tent or something, some kind of memorial for what he had seen had happened. But of course, he was just fearful. And that was the only reason that he had done what he had done. But while he was up there, though, people had come to the other disciples, and they had asked the other disciples if they would heal this young boy. This boy had what they called an unclean spirit. A lot of the symptoms that they talk about in the passage reminds one of the illness of epilepsy, where this young boy was foaming at the mouth, and he was, they said sometimes he foams at the mouth, and he goes into the fire, you know, be thrown into the fire and things like that. And they had asked the disciples that had been left behind to heal this boy. And they could not heal them. And they had actually healed people before them, and for some reason they could not heal them. And then when they came, when Jesus came back, there was this big commotion going on, and it has that favorite verse that some people like to quote, where this man, when he sees Jesus, he decides that I'm going to go to the guy, the real guy, you know, and he asks Jesus, he says, Jesus, you know, your disciples couldn't do it, you know, but if you can, you know, if you can, will you please do something? And then Jesus says, you know, in essence, if I can. You know, and the guy ended up saying, you know, he says, where's your belief? And he said to the guy, I do believe, help my unbelief. Anyway, later on, after he healed the boy, the disciples went to Jesus and said, you know, Jesus, why couldn't we do it? You know, why couldn't we drive it out? And this is the passage that is quoted on the top of the page, and where it says, Jesus replied, this can only come out by prayer. And in some of the manuscripts, it actually says by prayer and fasting as well. And one of the things by reading this passage that comes to my mind is that life brings about many situations that appear hopeless. It's very easy to go from a mountaintop experience like they went from the Transfiguration into really a feeling of being dejected, or that, you know, what's the use? And I know that if I relied on my feelings, that would be my life, because my feelings can go that way in the drop of a hat. I can be feeling wonderful, you know, life is great, you know, I have, you know, the life by the hook, you know, wonderful, this is very, very good. And then something can happen, you know, I can stub my toe, you know, or burn my finger, or somebody can say something to me and my feelings can get hurt, and then boom, you know, my feelings can plummet, you know, very, very low. And I'm so grateful that my faith is not dependent on my feelings. My faith is in the Lord Jesus Christ and in His Word, in the Word of God. And the Word of God is truth, and it is beyond my feelings. But I am very, very human, and sometimes I can forget the truth, and I'm grateful for, like I said, the written word, and also grateful for the community, because what I learned from the community is that I don't have to experience every experience in order to learn the lesson that the Lord wants me to learn. I can actually learn from other people. And so that's, again, another reason why I enjoy reading the Bible, because I learn a lot from the Bible. One of the things that I see in this particular passage is that, you know, Jesus had gone from a high point, you know, or the disciples actually too, being with Jesus, had seen his glory, very beautiful, where these three disciples had seen the glory of God, and then here they come down and they have to encounter a demon possessing a young boy. And that's very, very sad, you know, when you see that, you know, when you know that if your child is troubled, it's very hurtful to observe that. And even if you don't have children, you know the hurt of having a friend that's troubled, or maybe a sponsee who, for whatever reason, continues to go back to the food or go back to alcohol or drugs or whatever, and it's a very sad thing to witness that. And so you can still have that sadness in heart. And what I'm also learning is that as I come closer to the answer, Satan tries the full frontal attack, as I call it. That I remember one time reading this in the 24 Hours a Day, where they were talking about runners, and they said some of the saddest things to see is when a runner is running, and they're very close to the finish line, but because they're running so hard, they can't see how close they are. And yet people on the sidelines can see how close that runner is to reaching the finish. And they said that it's very, very sad when the runner just gives up and everyone in the crowd can just see how close they were to the end. And I know that that has happened in my own life. I have just, it used to be happening a lot with the food. I mean, it would be like, oh my goodness, I mean, it would be hard. I couldn't take it. And then I just gave in, you know. And then the next day, when all of the crazy feelings had gone away, I realized that whatever the problem was that I thought was so important that I had to eat about it, resolved itself. And I would say to myself, why didn't I wait, you know? And I had to eventually learn the lesson that when something became so important that I needed to eat about it, then it was too important. And so I'm also finding, too, that the devil, when I'm getting very, very close to the solution, I still need to stand firm, because I can rest assured that the devil is going to try to pull out the whole arsenal to try to scare me away from getting what God intends for me. It's funny, I've had that type of a situation today. I one of the jobs that I have is for the county. I work as what they call home and hospital teacher. They don't usually have the kids in the hospital anymore because they don't keep you in the hospital very long. But they, when a child has had either surgery or they have some kind of illness, they get a teacher to come and teach them at home. And so they had assigned a new student to me today, and I was going to meet him for the first time. And yesterday when they called me about it, they emailed me actually first about it. And part of me was like, oh no, I have so much to do. I can't possibly take another student. I just can't do it. And then I would remember, Pat, get on your knees and just ask the Lord to help you to make the right decision, you know, about that. Because I do turn them down sometimes. If it's a student that I realize that whatever it is that they want me to teach is going to take a whole lot of prep, that I can't do that, you know, because of the other obligations that I already have. But this particular student, it was a course they wanted me to do with him that I'm already teaching anyway. And so is I got on my knees and I asked the Lord, I said, Lord, please help me to know what to answer these people, whether to say, yes, I'll take the student, or no, you know, I won't take the student. And I got on my knees and I prayed, and it really fell into my heart, gee whiz, Pat, he's a ninth grader. You know, he's taking one of the courses that you already teach. You know, please, let's go and tell them yes. So I called her up and I said, yeah, I would take him. And she asked me to call the parent, and I called her, and the parent was really grateful, because I guess the student has been waiting for a teacher for about a month. And so I felt grateful that I had said yes, and I had planned to see him today. And so today, when I got up, of course, the voices were there to give me all kinds of commentary about, you know, it's going to be hard. You know, how could you have, you could have had this whole day to yourself, all right, if you hadn't taken that student. And you know what it's going to be like. You know, these are the voices in my head. You know it's going to be hard. You know, and what about that science course? Because they usually give you two courses. And I usually teach math. I've taught science before, but it's not my forte. And when I say yes, I also say yes to taking the science course also. And I had misread it. I thought it was chemistry, which was going to take some prep, but I didn't think it would kill me because I had done chemistry before. And so I went to the child. So I did go. I just had to say, you know, let these voices alone. I'm not going to concentrate on it. I'm not going to do it. Anyway, I came. I found the place. I had to Google it and find the place where he was. He was about 20 minutes away from me, and I went to his home. And I have to tell you, after I got in the car from work, I worked with him an hour and a half today, and I'm going to walk with him again tomorrow. And I was working with him, and I thought to myself, oh my goodness, I cannot believe how grateful this child is to be taught. I mean, here was this kid, he was a ninth grader, and his knee was, he had hurt his knee, and so he was limping. He had had surgery in his knee. It was the nicest kid, very, very nice kid, you know. And his mother was at work, and I guess his father is at home. He's not poor, but, you know, he's not by any means affluent or anything. He lived in an apartment. And he was apologizing to me for the noise, you know, that we could hear in the other apartments. And I was saying, oh, don't worry about that. I said, I lived in New York City above a pizza parlor one time. And I said, please, you know, you don't have to apologize. But as the time went on, I could feel him easing up, you know, that he was grateful that, you know, he wasn't afraid of me anymore. He could ask questions, and I could see that he was enjoying the time that we were having together. And when I got in the car later on, I thought to myself, I cannot believe that I was so negative about the situation. But this is how the demons work, okay? The demons know that if something is really going to be a blessing, then they will try even twice as hard to do something to block it. And this is what happened in this passage too, because once Jesus showed up on the scene, if you go ahead and read this passage, you can see the demons really started acting out. You know, they just went and you know, made him. It says in verse 20, and they brought the boy to him, and when the spirit saw him, meaning Jesus, immediately it convulsed the boy, and he fell on the ground and rolled about foaming at the mouth. You know, so that type of a thing, that's what it is that last effort, you know, to just do all kinds of craziness to make me get afraid again and to give up. And so it's so important for me not to base things on my feelings, but it's also important for me to pray continually, over and over again, and whatever it takes, you know, to pray. Even if I am feeling that, you know, I'm not being heard. I don't feel that usually, that I'm not being heard. I believe that the Lord hears me all the time, you know. But I also know that sometimes he says yes, no, and wait. And sometimes if I'm tired of waiting, I can still pray, you know, and to get on my knees every day, and to focus on him. And I learned that in my abstinence. I really and truly did. I learned that at the beginning of my abstinence, when I used to fight with the food, I was trying very hard to be abstinent. And usually when I least expect it, the thought would come, oh, you know, this is too hard, you can't do it, and I would want to give up. And I learned to pray. I learned to pray, oh Lord, please keep me abstinent. Please keep me abstinent. And then day after day, you know, he would help. And moment after moment, you know, I learned. And I also learned how to recognize that voice and recognize situations that I knew would also be followed sometimes by a big attack. One of the things in the reading, I'm going to go into the reading in the first paragraph, it says, it gives a definition for a stronghold, and it says spiritual strongholds are sinful patterns of thinking and acting. And I have come to understand that my overeating was definitely a spiritual stronghold. It was a pattern of thinking and eating. In fact, when I first was confronted with the possibility that it was a problem with my eating, it was like, oh, no, it's not my eating, it's just my weight. I just have a weight problem. I need to, if I can just find, you know, I was looking for the way that I could, you know, have the overeat and still, you know, be skinny. That was it. I didn't have any problem. I wasn't like an alcoholic, you know, I wasn't a drug addict, you know. And yet, if I was honest with myself, I could see that, yes, indeed, I was addicted to the way that I eat, the substance, the amount that I ate, how I ate, all of those things. Yet I was blinded to that sin. And again, like I said, I would get into an argument with you with a drop of a hat if you wanted to compare me to an alcoholic, you know, at one point in my life. And I didn't want to admit my sin. And I realized that there are strongholds all over. You know, people are under strongholds. And even those who know the Lord can still have their flesh have pockets of their life where they are, you know, having strongholds. In that second paragraph, it talks about the racism that can be rampant in a church, you know, where, again, people are in one area, you know, speaking the truth, talking about the Lord, and yet have this situation where they are feeling that they own the market to the Lord because of their nationality, their race, their denomination, you know, whatever, you know. And so we can have strongholds in our thinking in that way too. And then there's also the stronghold in the church as a whole with this overeating. I've heard a lot of people who are in recovery to overeating say that whenever they try to approach their pastor about, you know, doing something in the church about overeating, they get a lot of resistance. People don't like other people messing with their food. You know, a lot of people under the guise of fellowship overeat, overspend, you know, money that can be used for missions and whatever else can be used to have great feasts for oneself. And not that God does not say that we feast, because if you read the Bible, there were lots of feast days. So that is biblical. Yes, we do have feasts. It's also, but it is a problem though when that becomes just a cover up for gluttony. And so it also is a problem too when people are stuck in the addiction. Like it says in the reading, that some of the most beautifully gifted people are being stopped in their tracks because they feel ashamed about their body size. And this is people, these are people who are overweight, but there are also some people who have unnatural understandings of their bodies. They think that they're fat, you know, or they think that whatever, because again, it's that stronghold in their mind. And so I pray to be used to share my experience, my strength, and my hope. And in order to do that, I cannot be judgmental. And I have to also remember where I came from and to keep my hands clean for the Lord's sake. Anyway, I'm going to stop there. I'm going to see if our shepherd would like to share now or whether she would like to share at the end of the meeting. But April, would you like to share now?